has a lot of symmetry. Local gauge symmetry is an organizing principle that seems to suggest unification. And then enveloping structures such as we've heard of today, the past few days, all sorts of algebraic things we can embed it in, possibility that it becomes a supersymmetric world with string theory. All of that is very important and suggestive based on what the beautiful side of the standard model. But there's also a dark side of the standard model. And that basically is all of those parameters that we put in. And I don't know how to count them, but it's 20-something. And there are probably a lot more parameters that we just can't observe. For example, if you think about the CKM matrix, the plus 2/3 charge quarks have a mass matrix that is a unitary matrix times diagonal times unitary. The minus 1/3 quarks have a mass matrix that's unitary times diagonal times unitary. All four unitary matrices are different. And the only thing we get to see is the first unitary matrix dagger times the third unitary matrix. That's the CKM matrix. And then we remove some phases that we're free to get rid of. So we're left with three real angles and one CP phase. What happened to those other 24 mixing angles? They go away. We can't see them, but we'll presumably be able to see them if new interactions come along, or maybe not. But there are a lot of parameters. We don't know where these come from. And basically, we're lacking sort of a systematic organizing principle. Now, supersymmetry really didn't help a lot with the Higgs because you just added it in. You had to add it in pairs. It was a nice thing to do because you had these electron-like fields that were the superpartners, but they were still add-ons. And so this still is not understood, and we don't even really have a principle to address it. Beautiful principles years ago, including Technicolor, which were dynamical and so forth, have failed. So it's left this unlit, and I would like to try to shine light here at the expense of not spending a lot of time on the other stuff. If we can talk about unification and whatnot if you want, but I'm really going to focus on the dark side. So back in 81, I wrote my first scientific paper that I have any pride in. And it was inspired by some work by a good friend of mine, Graham Ross, and his student Pendleton. In fact, I'd been at Oxford talking to them. And what they had done is looked at the renormalization group running of the Higgs-Yukawa coupling of the top quark. What they focused on was basically the ratio of the top to the QCD coupling. And they got a trajectory that looked something like this. And that trajectory, if you are below it, you'll have an asymptotically free G-top. And if you're above it, you'll have a Landau pole. And I got back to Fermilab, and I was assigned the task of doing a journal club presentation. So I thought I'd do a journal club presentation on their talk. Your thesis advisor was there, in fact, Heini Veltman. And BJ and so forth is a lively atmosphere back then. So I took my little pocket calculator and I ran a computer program. And I started with random values of G and asked what happened. And what I found is this behavior. Some people call these nowadays focus points. I call it a quasi-fixed point. Because what's happening is if you treat a G3 as a constant, then basically large random values are going to come down to where this combination roughly vanishes. And there is motion of G3, so that's why this gets dragged along. But the focusing is really occurring in this region. If G3 didn't run, this would be a conformal system. You'd get to a conformal fixed point, the beta function would vanish. And it's this relic running of G3 that causes that to happen. But because the running is log, and this is log, the sensitivity here is log-log. So it's very insensitive to where you start. And I thought that's a nice thing. It was in 1981. I went around giving talks. I remember going to a meeting at Santa Cruz where people literally laughed at this. I had some people just laughing. How could anybody foolishly propose the top quark is this heavy? And indeed, at that time, the leading contenders for the top quark were predictions basically of the John Ellis group at 15 GeV, and Shelley had a prediction of 26 GeV. So this is where we thought the top quark would be in about 1981.
Those expectations?
Just symmetry arguments, you know. I think Shelley's was, let's look at the ratio of M charm over M strange and say that that's the ratio of MT over MB, something like that, and there's some renormalization effects thrown in. This was more or less some discrete symmetry they imposed, and Gaillard, Ellis, et al., there's some paper. I actually did a histogram plot one time of all the predictions for MTOP, and they were strongly peaked down in this region, and there were really no outliers. There was Pendleton and Ross, which wanted something like 110, and I was up here. There were bounds at that point that were higher, but this was there were unitarity bounds. Well, shortly thereafter, CERN discovered the top quark. Now, CERN didn't, actually. Some overzealous theorists got a hold of some data and applied through the data themselves and discovered the top quark at 40 GeV, and it created a bit of a scandal. CERN really did not back it, and indeed, it went away. And then when the Tevatron turned on, there were some people saying, we're going to eat our hats if the top isn't found immediately when the Tevatron turns on at 90 GeV. And it wasn't. And actually, we went through a long period then where we finally got to the discovery. In fact, for a while, the discovery was at a higher mass, and it eventually came down. It's gotten pretty precise. And this is what the renormalization group fixed point says it should be. And this is approximately two-loop precision. If you start at the Planck scale, you'd expect this. It's very hard to change those numbers with the contents of the standard model and adding gauge corrections. Changing the gauge group tends to raise it. For example, you can embed SU3 and SU3 cross SU3, but then both couplings are larger than the G3 you started with, so the fixed point goes up. So it's hard to find concordance. In the interim, before the top was discovered, though, because it wasn't showing up, Nambu had made some suggestive remarks that perhaps the Higgs itself is made of a pair of top quarks. And Bill Bardeen and I and Manfred Lindner, and there's some Japanese competition from Yamawaki, Tanabashi, and Maransky, basically codified that into a Nambu-Jones-Lacinio model. And a Nambu-Jones-Lacinio model is a very natural thing. If you had a gluon exchange, a massive gluon exchange, and you write it as a four Fermi interaction, say the gluon has a mass, you can Fiertz rearrange that, and you find the attractive channel is the Nambu-Jones-Lacinio model. There's a powerful technique for solving it using the renormalization group. But we did all the bubble sums, and then we thought, how can we get the correct answer using the renormalization group? And I remember Bill coming in my office, and he said, well, we know that the compositeness condition for a Higgs in an NJL-like model, in fact, it's a general statement. Weinberg had written some papers years earlier saying this. The compositeness condition is the vanishing of the kinetic term. So it's a vanishing of the Higgs wave function renormalization constant at the composite scale. And the Higgs becomes an auxiliary field at that scale. If you integrate it out, you recover the four Fermi interaction. And I just thought, whoa, if Z is zero, that means G top is infinite. That means it's a Landau pole. Therefore, the answer is the fixed point. So the fixed point comes back. It was the solution to the problem of how heavy is a Higgs made of TT bar. And again, it overshoots by about 20%, 30%. So for a long time, I've been interested in, is there any interesting model or simple extension or something that brings concordance of this prediction and corrects it by 30% and gets the top quark right? And so I finally entered a kind of something I always wanted to do with some junior colleagues who were too naive to realize they really shouldn't do this project. And I wanted to take the very large n limit and say, well, suppose we saturate the standard model with scalars. And they're all heavy. But somehow, for some reason, I still don't know the reason, some of them are trickling down and becoming light. Can we? What does that mean, and what would it lead to? And one thing it leads to, this is a subsector of such a theory, and one of my collaborators was a fellow named Anders Thompson, who's a graduate student of Francisco Cimino up in Southern Denmark University. Absolutely brilliant student, way ahead of the normal student level of development. Wrote the two-loop renormalization group equations down for an SU6 cross SU6 extension. And this is where you take, I'll show you in a moment, you take all the six quarks that are left-handed and the six quarks that are right-handed, and you just put a big sigma model in the middle. That contains 18 Higgs doublets. It's an SU6 left cross SU6 chiral Lagrangian. Not to be it's not a left-right symmetric model, it's a chiral Lagrangian. And it corrects this coefficient, not by a lot, but you get a bunch of leg renormalizations that weren't there before. And lo and behold, the whole thing shifts down now, and it's becoming concordant. Now, it's not an exact prediction from the fixed point alone, because you left behind in the sort of 100 TeV range a bunch of Higgses that decoupled. And so it propagates to the lowest energy as the standard model Higgs. So you've got to adjust for that. So what you get now is a prediction from the fixed point alone plus these mass corrections. And the mass corrections can be parameterized as approximately the average value of all the Higgses you decoupled times 2.8 log divided by 100. And if we take the average value of all these Higgses that we've now added in to be mass of order 100 TeV, indeed, we're concordant. Now, this isn't surprising, because every time we've discovered something new in the standard model, for example, when we got the W mass nailed down, well, actually, CERN gave us the best measurement there. The slack and the Tevatron together got the Z mass. Now you can predict the Higgs mass. Yes, with the top quark, you can predict. I want to say with that pair, we can get, I think, the top mass precisely. With the top and the Z, we get the Higgs mass precisely. Now we would say we know the theory of the top mass correctly. We can predict an intermediate scale of Higgs bosons. So I'm leveraging, you always leverage your current discovery with radiative corrections to get an next limit. So this would be sort of a rough estimate of what would happen in a very large number of Higgs boson model. So why should I think at all that the world has lots of scalars? And my hope was, in taking a very large n limit, statistical mechanics is, you know, it's the one-body problem is trivial, the two-body problem is solvable, the three-body problem is tough, the four-body problem is impossible, but the very large n limit is doable, again, by statistical mechanics. So I thought we might be able to go to a statistical limit where we could make some interesting statements. And let's just begin by asking, how many slots are available in the standard model for scalars? And I'm going to define a slot by taking one of the Weyl bilinears, put all the standard models into left-handed multiplets. They have 48 fields that are left-handed, that includes particle and antiparticle, and you can make this combination. And that puts you in a symmetric representation of SU48. So if there's a compositeness going on at some high scale that's universal, the way we would solve it, in analogy to NJL, is we would factorize the interaction and introduce an auxiliary field. That auxiliary field is going to integrate down to become our composite spectrum. What this gives you is the symmetric representation of SU48. They're all complex fields. And that's 1176 complex degrees of freedom. So 1176 slots for new scalars. If I had a strong universal interaction at something like the Planck scale, hint of what I'm thinking about, and I factorize it, I expect that I could get a very large number and would get a very large number of scalars. It's interesting to go to the standard model notation to see what this looks like. So in the standard model notation, where we have 24 left-handed fields and 24 right-handed fields, we have a big SU24 cross SU24 sigma model here. Then we've got a Majorana field coupled to left-handed, a Majorana coupled to right-handed. And if you do the counting, you indeed have 576 bosons in SU24 cross SU24, and plus 300 gives you the 1176 back. So that's how the standard model would parse these things. And in that chiral Lagrangian, we'd have a whole bunch of colored Higgs bosons, octets, color singlet Higgs bosons, leptoquarks, a whole morass of new scalars. Likewise here, you'd have a whole bunch of Majorana-like neutrinos. And if you want to look for where the Higgs is, it's in here somewhere. And what's interesting about these objects, and this is the theme, this is the organizing principle of this, and why I think it's interesting, is if you play this game this way, there's a universal Higgs-Yukawa coupling. Very few people, no one to my knowledge, plays with extended Higgs models where they put in a universality of the Higgs-Yukawa coupling. Yeah, then it's no, you need a symmetry. Here the symmetry is dynamical. It's a universal coupling starting at the composite scale and it comes down. It is subject to renormalization, so it's not exactly universal. In fact, what we find is leptons will get couplings of order 0.6, whereas all the quarks will get couplings that are basically G-top. So what we're predicting here is a big bunch of Higgs bosons in the quark sector, all coupled just like the top quark. Likewise, in the lepton sector, coupled by a factor of 0.6. And there are additional renormalization effects in the infrared when you start comparing M-top to MB, et cetera. And over here, we would like something to happen that causes a seesaw mechanism to get perhaps heavy right-handed neutrinos. That can naturally occur. Everything else that's kind of unwanted, like my colored Higgs, all of these lepto quarks, et cetera, I'm more or less going to keep them heavy. I don't have any theory of how to get from the composite scale down to the low energy scale, and predictively at this point. But what I will tell you is it's all going to be very technically natural. There's only one big additive quadratic divergence, and that will happen in the trace of capital phi dagger phi. That's the analog of the quadratic divergence in the Higgs mass. Everything else is going to be explicit symmetry break.
Where are all the gauge couplings? And what's the gauge sector?
The gauge sector here so far can just be standard model.
No, because then there's so many scalars and spinners that the top doesn't put it free.
Oh, you're worried about unification?
Well, no.
So if colored scalars, let's say Higgs octets are at 10 to the 15 JeV, you don't care about asymptotic freedom. You care about unification.
But there's so many scalars and spinners around.
Yeah.
The theory goes as you lump one ball much sooner.
Well, what I need to do, if you're right, if I knew that QCD continues to be asymptotically free up to 1,000 TeV, then I want to postpone the colored objects from becoming active. So they would have to be heavy. So my view is take the colored Higgses and keep them heavy. They didn't come down. I know that's ad hoc. I don't know what the pattern of breaking is, but my breaking is all dimension two operators, which are explicit mass terms and mixing terms. So I'm just free to say unwanted, perverse things that are going to ruin asymptotic freedom are simply heavy, and they haven't entered yet. You can do unification in this game, and I can later perhaps show you some analysis of that. And by the way, this is the standard model decomposition of the 576. And here's your 18 quarkish Higgs bosons at the top. They're 18 degrees of freedom, so they form doublets. They're 18 doublets, 18 complex plus 18 complex for upright and downright. And then we have the similar thing for the leptons. So this is a total of 18 doublets for quarks, 18 doublets for leptons, then all this other junk that's unwanted, and I'm going to keep it heavy. By the way, even though these are leptoquarks, if they don't get VEVs, you don't violate baryon number or lepton number. It's carried by the quark. Okay, I'm decoupled here. I'm saying you can carry those quantum numbers unless it got a VEV. We want to avoid those from getting into the infrared. All right, so this is just a counting argument. We may have already seen one of them. And in fact, I think I usually say if I've seen this one Higgs, and by the way, the Higgs we see couples to 72 of those bilinears, but it does so with very weak coupling. The only strong coupling of the Higgs is to T bar left, T right. So everything else, like charm bar left, charm right, electron left, electron right, tiny, tiny couplings. But if you count them all, it's 72. Why would nature give you one scalar that couples in a weird way to 72 of the available bilinears? So I invoke the dead mouse in the house hypothesis. You've seen a mouse, you threw it out, you've gotten rid of all the mouses, obviously. Now, this is the most generous possible thing you could do. I haven't been smart here. I haven't imposed conditions that will restrict the spectrum, and I would expect that's going to happen. But once again, the extreme maximal case is interesting, so I want to proceed. Again, if I look at the standard model decomposition, as I said, these are the Higgses that are of interest. And what happens is very nice. I was always struck by the fact that if you talk about mass generation for the proton and neutron, you know, it looks like this: proton, neutron left, proton, neutron right. And there's a big complex 2x2 matrix here. And that condenses, and it gives you the octet of Nambu pseudo-Goldstone bosons, and the zero plus mesons go up when it condenses, the Nambu Goldstone bosons come down. But the standard model, well, the standard model, top, bottom, left, sigma, can be written the same way. It's just that this sigma is the Higgs, and then epsilon times the Higgs charge, the same field, charge conjugated, where epsilon is a small number, mb over m top. So why is the standard chiral dynamics SU2 left plus SU2 right symmetric? Why is the standard model asymmetric? Well, it doesn't possess that dynamics, or if it does, it's broken somehow. And so what we're basically doing is saying it does possess this dynamics. It's just that that thing starts life as another Higgs, HB, and HB picks up a piece that's epsilon HH by mixing. And is otherwise, it becomes that plus a fluctuating piece that's very heavy and decouples.
So your H is a matrix.
This is the standard model Higgs doublet. This is a 2x2 matrix. This is a doublet. This is its charge conjugate. This is the standard model with one Higgs. I'm saying that Higgs is actually a new Higgs, H sub B, that has mixed with the standard model Higgs and has a big, heavy fluctuating piece as well. And that's therefore saying above the scale, and this, by the way, is going to happen at about 3 to 5 TeV. So this is going to be the way the world looks above that scale. So this is dynamical. It's maximally dynamical. And they have a similar thing for leptons. And the key, and I want to emphasize this again, the predictive thing of this scheme is the universality of the Higgs-Yukawa coupling. So, you know, the way we look at the standard model is one Higgs, and we have these technically natural things. Technical naturalness is a beautiful thing. It's, you know, it solves the problem that every graduate student wants to do initially in particle physics. She comes in and says, I want to calculate the mass of the electron using a Feynman diagram, and I want it to be alpha times the mass of the muon. And what technical naturalness says is you can't do that. Perturbatively, you can't do that. Because if the mass of the electron starts zero, it stays zero. Because there's a right-handed electron chiral symmetry that is protects the perturbative expansion. It will not induce that result. So that's a beautiful thing. It means the masses are multiplicatively renormalized. And so the way we look at it is electron mass is small. It's just going to stay small because it's multiplicatively renormalized. The flip side of that is that there's actually a challenge built into that. Because try to construct a theory in which G electron starts life at 10 to the minus 6. Because the renormalization group's going to keep it at that order up to the Planck scale. It's multiplicatively renormalized, and it's perturbatively renormalized. So it's going to stay small. It's very hard to engineer a theory that directly makes G electron 10 to the minus 6. I mean, we've thought about ways of doing it with instantons and other things getting in. But if you look at what essentially anybody does who tries to construct a theory, G electron is starting at order 1, and then it's mixing and getting power loss suppression, mu squared over m squared. So the 10 to the minus 6 is some mixing mu squared divided by some big denominator m squared to some power, and that's how we expect to get the hierarchy. If I combine that wisdom, which is experience, that's the way, even in extra dimensions, you try to separate the brains that the different things live on, and you get this hierarchy that way. It's still a suppression factor of something starts out as one. So if I combine that sort of wisdom with the dead mouse in the house hypothesis, why not let these Higgses do it? We're arguing there's a universality of Higgses coming from some kind of universal unknown binding. we can engineer all of the couplings we want by now not analyzing Higgs-Yukawa textures, because the textures are all one, but by analyzing the mass structure of these Higgs bosons. So we flip the problem into a hierarchy of Higgs bosons and not a hierarchy of Higgs-Yukawa couplings. So in some sense, we've flipped the problem from dimension four operators that are renormalized multiplicatively into dimension two operators. And you can view those as soft symmetry breaking, if you want. This issue is certainly, as I say, the only naturalness issues in the common diagonal, which has the vacuum quantum numbers. Everything else we're going to add is breaking some symmetry, so it's equally technically natural. That in itself is a very interesting question.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Is that better?
Pardon?
Is it better?
Well, it's an equal amount of ignorance at the moment.
Yeah.
But I'm going to show you soon, I better act soon, how it works in a subsector. And that's really the only way I can see to analyze this at present, is to zoom in on a subsector where we will solve the problem of where a small Higgs-Yukawa coupling came from in this game. So as I said, dimension two soft symmetry breaking, that's an old theme from chiral Lagrangian days where people would write down the symmetry is all carried by the dimension four operators, then you'd break it by adding lower dimension operators. The breaking does not propagate back to the higher dimension operators, so it's in some sense safe to do that. This is what, if I turned off CKM mixing, just ignored it. Actually, this thing, if I do that and just look at the diagonal Higgses, the things that couple to QRQ, I'm then doing something called the private Higgs model of Porto and Z. There might be a few other authors in there. There are a few papers they've written. They're nice papers where they've sort of anticipated this structure, but they're only putting the Higgses on the diagonal. They're not doing the full glory. So to get the CKM mixing, they still put that in by hand, all the mixing angles and whatnot. We're more ambitious, but we haven't solved it. If I turn off the CKM, what I'm allowing is a mixing mu squared between a given Higgs and the standard model Higgs, and a big mass m squared for the particular big Higgs that's doing the mixing. This is sort of the upper range of masses for the Higgses. The Higgs that couples to E bar E has a mass of a few 10 to the 4 TeV. The Higgs that couples to strange down is in this range. The B quark, you can see, that Higgs is in the in the middle of the 3 to 5 TeV range. That's for a particular assumption about the pattern of mu. And this is a more extreme assumption about the pattern for mu. And you can see that this sort of brackets the allowed ranges of these diagonal Higgses. And I tend to favor this, as you'll see, for the following reason. I do not want to spend time on this. But we blasted away with the CKM matrix and took sample models using a computer and said, when are we consistent with all of the CKM bounds, all the flavor physics bounds? And there certainly are solutions, different benchmarks. The toughest problem are these orange lower bounds that pertain to the kaon, k long k short mass difference. And here's a failure. I believe this one's the failure. Which one's the failure? There's one where, the strange quark Higgs, that's the strange quark Higgs, the thing coupled to SS bar, is bounded below by that orange band up there. And you see for this benchmark, it violated, it came out below. But generally, we find consistency. And this is the kind of study that's a statistical study. I don't like these scatter plots of all possible SUSY models. I don't like all possible Higgs models either. But it's a search for consistent solutions. And I'm just claiming they exist. I'm not going to go into detail on this. You can look at our paper. All right, so this, you know, looks like a big beehive of stuff that we'll probably, we think, never see. What might convince us of it? Remember the universality, G equals one. So what would be the first sequential new Higgs? And it turns out in this scheme, it's almost always, and I think it's almost a theorem, going to be the thing that couples to the B quark. And I call it H sub B. So it's the second column of this over here.
Sorry, can you remind us what G is?
The Higgs-Yukawa coupling. So what I'm saying is, if we focus on the top-bottom sector, where this does look like a SU2 left cross SU2 right sigma model, we have a pair of Higgses, standard model Higgs, the B-quark Higgs, and this is the thing that will be the first sequential partner. And the Yukawa coupling G is one. It's common. We've seen it already. We've already measured it to high precision. And the B quark is going to inherit the same Higgs Yukawa. So this type of two doublet model is unique. I actually proposed it some years ago doing Coleman-Weinberg for the Higgs. I needed a second Higgs to do it. And I just took G equal 1 because I had the flexibility to take any G, but G equal 1 made it more visible. Now I have a symmetry principle of sorts to argue that that happens. You can forget the whole thing I've just told you if you just want to say the standard model has a gauge, a group, approximate symmetry, which is not a Patti Salam. It's an SU2 left cross SU2 right cross U1 cross U1, and it's a symmetry of the dimension 4 operators, but we are going to break it by adding operators that break the U1 axial, break this down to U1 hypercharge, and break the SU2 right, and those are natural. So it looks something like this. So the chiral version, so sigma is the two doublet sigma field, and these are the operators I add to the potential. And they're very reminiscent from chiral theory. That's the usual quartic interaction. That is another allowed quartic interaction. This is Gerard's determinant for solving the U1 problem. That's the sigma model mass term. And notice all of them, with the exception of the first one, are breaking a symmetry of some sort, and therefore they're technically natural. Or they're dimension 4. Dimension 4 is multiplicatively renormalized. These two, Anyway, that's a common feature here. If I now, and there's a whole bunch of disallowed dimension 4 operators because of the symmetry I've imposed. I can write this again in Higgs notation, and this is what the potential looks like. And now I'm going to simply argue that the dominant mixing effects here, remember, the second doublet is not in a Mexican hat potential. And in fact, I'm going to now even take the standard model Higgs not to be in a Mexican hat potential. I'm going to give it a positive M squared that's small. Don't have to do that. We look at the general case, but we don't have any tachyonic potential. This is what we have with positive M squareds. Let's look for the VEVs. So it's easy to solve this in that approximation. The VEV of the HB is a tiny fraction of the VEV of the standard model Higgs, and it's aligned. Substitute that back in, and a remarkable thing happens. What was a positive MH squared is, well, it's not so remarkable, it's level repulsion. It gets repelled down by its mixing and can become negative. There's every reason to think that the Higgs mass could be arbitrarily small. Probably the smallest value it could ever have because of mixing with QCD is of order 1 GeV, because it will mix through QCD effects to the capital sigma meson. But you know that may be a small effect in itself. So my bare theory could start with a Higgs mass that's anywhere from maybe the weak scale on down to a very small zero, something close to zero. And this will guarantee a tachyonic potential by the level mixing.
When you say level mixing, it's just a classical
combination. Yeah. So here's my Higgs, and here's my HB without mixing. Now I turn on mu squared, that goes down, this goes up. And if this is zero, the Higgs goes negative. I'm not relying on that, I'm just saying it happens, it's a nice thing. And it turns out, assuming that is actually almost a zero fine-tuning limit of this game. And so now I find that my H sub B is some fluctuating massive field plus a mixture with the Higgs and the Higgs VEV. And so now I want to calculate the B quark mass. I put H sub B back as that mixed thing that you just saw. And I have the standard model Higgs giving the top its mass. And so I see immediately the bottom mass is given by the top mass times this small ratio, and there's a small renormalization effect you have to worry about in running from top down to bottom from QCD. That's about a factor of 1.5. Put that together, and you predict the mass of the B Higgs, and it's 5.5 TeV. And that is, in the simplest case, if I now allow a positive m squared of the Higgs to keep the net physical Higgs mass down. We know the negative m squared term. It's minus 88.4 GeV squared. That's known from the, it's 1 over square root of 2 of the Higgs mass in the Lagrangian. That's the Lagrangian mass of the Higgs. We know that fact. To keep that fixed, adding a cancellation between a bare Higgs mass and the level repulsion effect, obviously I'll be fine-tuning a quadratic difference if I take the bare mass too large. So I don't want to do that. I could in principle do it, so you could say that it's not really predictive. If the bare mass is zero, it's absolutely predictive. So as I say, this is, well, let me proceed. We can include the third generation. I'm going to skip the details. What happens if we just keep the tau Higgs in the game and the B Higgs is we find that they lie on an ellipse. This is the ellipse. So m naught squared would be the bare Higgs mass. Let's see, well, what is what? For one of these is the, yeah, m naught squared is the 88.4 GeV squared. MH squared is the bare Higgs mass, which I was setting to zero before, but I'm going to now allow it. And what happens is the B Higgs and the tau Higgs end up on an ellipse. And now I find the typical values are about 3.56 TeV for the B Higgs and about 4.2 TeV for the tau Higgs. And that's assuming that the neutrino Higgs is quite heavy. This is a Dirac seesaw if I do that. If I do a Majorana seesaw, then the neutrino Higgs can be in the same ballpark, and now they lie on a much larger ellipsoid. And again, the tendency to go further, adding these things in that are near the third generation, is to suppress the predicted mass for the H sub B. So 5.5 is kind of a natural upper limit. And we did some sensitivity studies. Don't I show it here? Yes, well, this, of course, is a fine-tuning study. And this is delta is, in some sense, sigma. So you're very fine-tuned as you go out to masses much bigger than this region. And in this region, you can compress it down by bringing more of the Higgses in, ignoring all but H sub B, H sub tau, and the standard model Higgs, and setting the bare Higgs mass to zero using only level repulsion puts you on this curve. So the real question is, can you find this thing? Now, this is the cross-section. It's produced at LHC by intrinsic B. Now, people have talked about this for a long time. Intrinsic charm is speculative. Intrinsic B is actually calculated. And it's basically making a B structure function and doing the ladder sum of gluons to get a well-defined. All of the simulators have it. So there's, in the structure function of the proton at 10 TeV or whatever, there is a B quark and an anti-B. So it's that intrinsic BB bar collision that's making H sub B. These are the cross sections you get at different energy machines. This is the current LHC, the doubler, the 100 TeV machine. And now you can ask, what does it take to get a 5 sigma discovery? And I remind you, the way you do that is you look at the BB bar mass distribution. You'll just get lots of data, and you'll just fit that with a quintic polynomial. And you'll look for a 5 sigma deviation. And with G equal 1 and the mass of 5.5 TeV, this is a rather broad state. It's about 300 GeV broad. But you're sitting up at 10 TeV, so it's not much worse than, this is how the Higgs boson was found. You fit the background, and you look for the 5 sigma bump in the gamma-gamma spectrum, and then later the BB bar spectrum. So this is what the 5 sigma threshold requirements are. If you want to find, so LHC now, if they can run for 10 inverse attobarns, which is, if they've got nothing better to do, they can certainly do that, can do a 5 sigma discovery of a 3.5 TeV Higgs, H sub B. If we just build the doubler and we run for the same 10 inverse Attleborns, which is easier to do with the higher energy machine because you get the luminosity for free at some level, we can see the 5.5. And you can see that's the green curve. The LHC is the blue curve. You can see it's spectacular if you build the 100 TeV machine. We could see probably a dozen of these objects with the 100 TeV machine out through CHARM, et cetera. You can actually get a handle on the tau. So just a quick summary of production and detection if you're interested. LHC currently has the capability of bounding this in the 1 TeV region, and I'm astonished they haven't. And I could keep knocking on doors of Atlas people at Chicago, CMS people at Fermilab, and I'm always told, go away, kid, we still have this SUSY study to finish. So I'm hoping to convince them that there's another view of the world. And I believe this H sub B exists. It can be discovered, certainly, at the energy doubler. Now, CERN's talking about skipping that and going straight for 100 TeV. I think that's dangerous business, but that's their, I'm not an engineer of accelerators. And notice that this, in a sense, has given us an explanation of the Y sub B. In the standard model, we input a coupling to the Higgs of 0.024. And if we find this thing, it's at 5 TeV, and we will immediately know that G equals 1 from its width. We've explained why that is 0.024. We've explained something that's otherwise one of these murky mysteries and swapped it for something else we don't understand, which is the mass of the B, H sub B. But that's how it works. So I hope I've convinced you that this deeper view isn't so bad, and that in fact we need to have principles to throw at it to try to understand it. I'm going to stop now, but I have some ideas on where this universal compositeness might come from. And of course, I think it's gravity. And I think that to do that, we need a non-perturbative effect in gravity. So if you want to hear more in the discussion, I'm happy to talk about it. But this is where, as I've said, if this thing is proven to be wrong by CERN, I will resign my position. Well, fortunately, that's probably beyond my current horizon. But
so just take yours recording.
Okay, no, it's okay.
I didn't fall.
So just to calibrate, how deeply did you believe your previous model?
The top fix went very strongly. I still do. As you can see, I've managed to pull it down to concordance. Now, I believe that that was really telling us something.
So if this one is proved wrong, will you also try to fix it?
I won't have time. No, I won't. I mean, this is my swan song. So if it's... I just think it's so unnatural to have a world with one dead mouse and nothing else in the house. And I think given that you believe there's going to be other stuff in the house, let's combine it to try to explain the phenomenology we don't understand. And you need a principle to do that. Otherwise, you're just shooting in the dark. The principle is G equals 1. Or G is at a Landau pole for all of these at the Planck scale. And what happens as you come down depends critically on various renormalization effects, et cetera.
But what is that symmetry argument? Can they say something about that?
Well, I would say that you have these SU48, you have these 1176 bilinears, okay? If I had a strong interaction at gravity scale, it's flavor blind, it's color blind, it's a strong scale, it can make an auxiliary field that is the theta that couples universally to all of those bilinears. And therefore, they all start at a common Landau pole. Now I use block spin renormalization group, as we do for the Nambu General Asinio, to come down. And I will find...
Can you say a little more about the theta? How does the theta gravity?
Well, that's the more stuff I'd like to talk about. Let me just give you a brief sketch of how this works. You imagine in Nambu General Asinio, which is not the only way to do compositeness, but it's the back of the envelope way to do it. Say at some scale, I have a left-handed, a right-handed, and a left-handed divided by some lambda squared. Okay. Now that can come very nicely, for example, from a color current. on a vectorial color current divided by lambda squared. And then these are all color singlets. And these are color singlets, okay? Now, the normal way people solve this is by bubble summing, which is large N fermion loop approximation. And that's crude. Wilson taught us the right way to do it. And he said, replace this at the scale lambda by psi bar left field H psi right minus lambda squared. By the way, there's a G squared here. Minus lambda squared H dagger H. And there's a G here, okay? Now, calculate these Feynman diagrams plus dot, dot, dot. And what you'll find is this loop will induce a kinetic term for H. It'll also induce a running of lambda squared minus G squared over 8 pi squared n lambda squared minus mu squared. So if G exceeds a critical value defined by this being 1, then you'll go into a tachyonic mode as mu goes to 0. And that's the BCS critical coupling. And n is the large N parameter. This is BCS theory, actually, where n is number of colors. You'll also induce a lambda H dagger H, H dagger H. So the technology of doing this is fairly straightforward. And that's what we did for top compositeness. And we found what you find is that this Z is proportional to a log of lambda squared over mu squared. So I'm descending to a lower energy scale mu. And that's Wilson's idea, that the Lagrangian runs. See that as mu approaches lambda, Z goes to 0, which realizes the compositeness condition, that H is an auxiliary field. Now, we can apply this to gravity. We can do stress tensor, stress tensor. You can certainly do that. In fact, it's a very hot topic in string theory at the moment. It's called the TT problem. It's not T duality. I just became aware of an industry that's going on there. See the one? What's the famous female at Stanford? Can't think of her name.
Silverstein.
She's been very active. She gave a bunch of talks at Aspen on it. And there's a whole group, a whole nest of people doing TT. Well, I do TT the poor man's way, and I try to Fierce rearrange. And I can get an NJL structure out of it and wave my hands. And so this would be a poly-Fierce graviton exchange interaction. But you don't have an N factor anymore. This doesn't give me an N enhancement. So therefore, I need something non-perturbative, and that's what I would be happy to discuss in discussion. And I'd love to hear your input. And it has a lot to do with his ideas on holography, and would certainly appreciate that input. So,
A very short question. So you would expect some of the bosons to induce flavor-changing neutral currents. So can you predict the mass of those bosons?
Because I showed you the benchmark study. And so
this is what the bounds are then.
Yeah, so we had the basically DD bar, B sub S mixing, and K long, K short, which always turns out to be, I'm surprised to this day, it was a big constraint back in 1979. It's still, 76, whatever, it's still a big, see, Weinberg and Glashow sort of set a stage for thinking about Higgses by imposing discrete symmetries that restricted the number of Higgses and blocked flavor-changing neutral currents. We obviously aren't doing that. But those symmetries are irrelevant once Higgs masses start getting up above 10 to 100 TeV, except for the K-long, K-short mass difference. And that seems to require at least 10 cubed TeV, especially when G is 1. So these benchmarks, we found quite a few failures, but we also find quite a few successes. And we can sort of actually understand why some succeed and don't.
So sorry, just to clarify, this HB model doesn't have trouble with?
No, that doesn't have any problem. What I've done there is I've just thrown everybody away except the top-bottom subsystem and just to see what's going on and understand sort of how the...
So there was no deep reason why you avoided flavor-changing?
That would have BB bar mixing contributions that are not naturally suppressed. But those constraints, I think I showed one of the benchmarks and it allowed the 3.9 TeV H sub B mass. So yes, that is a potential contribution. So in other words, the Weinberg-Glashow naturalness was a good principle to guide your thinking about Higgses. But once you start thinking about ultra heavy Higgses and lots of them, it's really kind of irrelevant. And yet it's remarkable how tenacious the K-long, K-short mass difference bound is.
Those very large centrifuges you talk about, so are they global groups? Or
global, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, broken by soft breaking.
Okay.
So my idea, I don't have a theory. I mean, I freely confess, there's no theory of all the M squareds of these, other than that your technical naturalness recurs because most of them, except for the diagonal, are breaking discrete symmetries, or global symmetries, and are custodially protected, or technically natural, just like the electron mass. I mean, I think it's very interesting because it's everybody thinking about CKM thinks about how can I get this texture, or that texture of the dimension four couplings. And this is saying, no, swap the problem for the mass spectrum of a bunch of Higgses. And maybe you'll have a clever idea that I haven't had, if I've had any.
I'm not a particle physicist, so I'm not so versed in the jargon of the subject. But one thing that I, maybe not relevant to this, but what I always wondered, if you extrapolate these running couplings all the way to the Planck scale, shouldn't you also consider couplings of the scalar fields to the curvature?
Yes, certainly. Those run. So if the standard model Higgs coupled to R with order one, I don't think you'd ever see an effect at low energies. They're going to run. It depends on what scale. So we play that game. We play it in the context of Weyl symmetry, where the Planck mass is a phi squared R coupling, and phi gets a VeV, and they have to worry about running effects of zetas. Typically, there, I more or less, just because I haven't looked at it in detail, considered far infrared scalars that have those couplings and what zeta does. I have done the renormalization group running of zeta for the Higgs. And that's remarkable because it goes to a sixth. Once you tune a hierarchy, it flows to a sixth, which is the conformal value. I completely forgot. We've included the running of G top, the running of lambda, the running of zeta.
It's not a relevant coupling.
So you notice that we get the quasi-infrared fixed point, and that means if you start life at the Landau pole at M Planck, and you're allowing physics to run down to the weak scale, it's a large range of running, things will flow toward fixed points. You'll flow toward a conformal limit. And zeta does exactly that. It flows to a sixth. And I think that might be known in general, that's the fixed point. The running of zeta is proportional to zeta minus a sixth, times some function of all that. So once you get to that fixed point, it stays there. And so this tuning, the quasi-infrared fixed point would be a true fixed point if G3 didn't run, and it's trying to get to a fixed point to make the conformal hierarchy, this conformal behavior of the theory. It's sort of a self-consistency thing. It's like, I think of axial anomalies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.